This week on Decentralized,
the virtual world frontier,
panarchy, anarchy, and alternative governance.
And we're joined by Suzanne Templehoff of BitNation and Dan Metcalf of BlockNet.
I'm Tony Sakic.
I'm James Walpole.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralized.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Decentralized. We have some exciting topics to talk about, as usual, as well as some great guests. Suzanne Templehoff of BitNation and Dan Metcalf of BlockNet will be joining us later in the show to talk about some interesting applications of blockchain technology. And we've seen plenty of those for sure. But of course, this has very specific applications in sort of political theory. So we don't usually talk about politics on this show because politics kind of sucks. But we're going to talk about some interesting topics in tech, which have some interesting implications for political theory and political philosophy. So how are you doing today, Eric?
Absolutely fantastic.
And I know you're pretty excited about this first topic. One of the things I wanted to talk about was the idea of virtual worlds and what those mean for individuals living in political societies, but maybe just more in general. What it means to interact in a virtual world, what effects it has on culture, on creativity, on even on trade and economics. So I'm not very familiar with virtual worlds. I never really played Second Life, played Sims or SimCity, but never really participated too much in that scene. But I know you have quite a bit of experience in it, Eric. What is it about virtual worlds that's so attractive to people? Where do you think that technology stands now? And why do you think it's so significant for people?
Well, I mean, look, virtual worlds have been around since for a very long time, since the very first work of fiction was written, right? Like that is a virtual world that doesn't manifest itself in reality. Instead, it's a creation of some author. What's new and interesting, I would say, for the past, there's a couple new and interesting things over the past 100 or so years. Sort of in the 1800s, you know, science fiction really became, or fiction in general became a thing that people read. And so you had this explosion of interest in these alternative realities. And then it really became a thing sort of in now that we're entering the information age with, you know, I think what people more traditionally think of things, think of a virtual world as a multi-person virtual world where you had the first phase where you could consume a virtual world that someone else had written, a work of fiction, and it was completely by construction of them. And you sort of, by your readership, would experience it. And it could be amazing and fantastic in the literal senses of those words. once we got to the point of computing and information, you could now interact with those worlds. And it was largely limited to you as an individual. Video games, you know, starting actually in the 60s. And, you know, these research machines and these sort of, you know, often text-based adventures, sort of the very first games were purely text-based, right? And people could experience these fictional worlds as a single person, and it was a very limited experience. But then as we got into the 70s, and I have to, you know, tip my hat to Lucasfilm for their Star Wars fame, of course, because they actually were one of the early pioneers of sort of these virtual worlds. These were completely fantastic, fictional places. You know, you read books, you got fascinated by them, the characters, the depth, the universes that you were exploring, completely unlike anything anyone has ever experienced. But it's imaginative. For the first time, companies like Lucasfilm in this late 70s and early 80s started building these virtual worlds. And games, by their very extension, are sort of this. Games can be simple and sort of, you know, you start having like Pong, right? Like that's very simple. But then you have these fictional worlds where people can go in and experience them. And I think what it is it's a forced mind shift for a lot of people. And for those of us who are caught in the drudgery and the, you know, tax farming that we all live in today, I mean, a lot of people seek that kind of escape. And as the internet kind of came along, it expanded into from single player experiencing these virtual worlds to multiplayer. And that's where we end up with things like Second Life and a number of other very interesting virtual worlds where people can not only experience the world by themselves, but experience the world alongside of someone else. And it's a completely different reality. It's a complete alternate reality. And I think that it serves a lot of psychological benefit for a lot of people.
It does seem pretty significant. I mean, obviously, this category is very broad. The virtual, if we think of the virtual world, it's just sort of a different place, an imaginary place. Like people say, you know, books take you to different places, and it's true. But there does seem to be something very significant about that multiplayer emergence of a place where you as an individual can go recreate a lot of things in your life, or maybe create something entirely new, culturally, personally, whatever. That, and especially, I think, going back to your point, that it allows people to escape from things which you're not satisfied with. Oftentimes, like you said, tax farming, like you said, sort of bad political situations, bad cultural situations, bad family situations. What's so significant to me about this, what attracted my interest in this, was I actually recently listened to a podcast called The Exodus to a Virtual World. And this was an interview on the podcast Econ Talk, one of my favorites, probably one of the best podcasts out there, present company excluded, of course. And one of the topics in this was really kind of talking about how this affects people's lives. And another great essay that really connects, I think, this idea of the virtual world to political theory, like we were saying earlier in the show, is another kind of famous one called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty by Albert O. Hirschman. And I'm a little bit less familiar with the details of this essay, but the main concepts are that there are three ways to respond to a bad political situation, a bad economic situation, whatever it happens to be. I think in this case, it's actually customer theory. But you can respond by exiting. You can leave the situation, not purchasing. You can respond with voice, by voicing criticisms. Or, of course, you can have loyalty. But what virtual worlds seem to provide is a way of exit, and a way of, if you can go into this new world and kind of create your own society, your own life, that's pretty significant, like politically. And it's not through political action. It's not through the voice. It's not through just recommitting through loyalty. It is a way for people to secede in a world where secession is not really super cool anymore.
Totally. I mean, you're sort of touching on this idea that it's escapism, right?
Which is somewhat, in a good way,
in the best, most positive of lights, right? Rather than being confined to these rigid rules that we have not only constructed around ourselves, but have been imposed upon us by the simple laws of physics, right? We can instead create a completely different reality, right? This can be dangerous, too, for many personality types. This can be dangerous. But you can literally create a completely artificial reality that becomes a reality of its own, a truer reality in a different sense. And I think this impacts... This has therapeutic benefits. This has, I know for me, for one, you know, when I'm really stressed out, you know, sometimes I need to disconnect and just go play a game, right? Go experience something that separates me from, you know, things that I've been experiencing through, you know, whether it be work or personal life or whatever have you. And I think, you know, as a kid, it was the imaginative aspect that struck me. And, you know, I'm not old enough necessarily to have experienced some of the very earliest games, but Zork was one fantastic game that was just purely text-based back in the day, and it was just totally, totally unheard of for people to go into this fantasy land, right? In the traditional high fantasy sense, in the case of Zork, it was an adventure game, a chance to go, you know, test your merit, test your wit and your grit, if you will, to go experience a world where there were trolls and goblins and see how you interacted with that. And honestly, growing up personally, I caught the tail end of this. I participated in MUDs, this thing, M-U-D, mm-hmm. all caps, called a multi-user dungeon. And I did this when I was probably 8 years old, you know, dialing into a number. And,
oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. And wow. It would feed back the computer the experience that the MUD operator had set up. And it was just amazing, right? Like, you could explore some world with dragons and wizards, and it was all text-based. There was no graphics whatsoever. It was just literally written description. And that was my earliest experience. And then it went into, like, well, if they can do that, why don't we create our own, right? Like, why do I have to experience someone else's world? I want to create my own world. And you get to this idea of having the ability to create, to provide value. Because anything that you create for yourself that you find fascinating is something that can be consumed by somebody else. This has many other economic implications, of course. It applies directly to that. But you know, at the time, I was too young to really to really learn to know exactly how to code and how to build a MUD and all of the mechanics and how to build the combat system and the quest system and the governance system. I was too young for all of that. So instead, I adopted this thing called freeform role-playing. And what it is simply very, very loose societal rules around writing something about something that you're doing and then interacting with other people who also do the same thing. And there's an overlap between what your characters are doing with one another. And subsequently, you can go on adventures. You can go, conquer these imaginary quests and come back and reap the spoils. And from that, from the conflict that arises between your interest in your character and their interest in their character, there arises story. And this lasted very long for me, all throughout my childhood and into my adulthood. And this actually contributed, I think, to my ability to communicate, ultimately. I would not have had the exposure to literature that I would have. I mean, I was obviously a bookworm, right? I think a lot of us have had that experience. And I read everything that I could get my hands on. But this idea of creating rather than consuming was, and I only look at it like that in retrospect, as to why I got so fascinated by it. This idea of like producing something and letting other people experience that and change it in unexpected ways was really what got me. And I subsequently, the very first like massive project that I really started, Roleplay Gateway, was exactly that. It was a platform for people to go do this on. And it was the first and still successful thing that I do today. And I think a lot of people who come back and they sort of like tell me like, you know, this has been around for over a decade now, and for my particular project.
Old man.
I am an old man. It's really awkward. Anyways, it's really cool though. Like the same feeling that I got when, you know, I was maybe an early teenager, maybe, and I was starting to actually take my writing seriously. And the benefits that I think I got from that, right, I start to get like emails and private messages from people who are using or doing these things on my site who are saying like, thank you so much for creating, for giving this opportunity for us to do this. It has made me into a better person. Or in some cases, some of the people that I've been with, some of the people that have written with me, been writers alongside me, have gone on to become professional writers. And that's just like, I'm not sure if it's nature versus nurture or like which side of that falls on, but it gets you thinking like this actually has these virtual worlds, these fictional realities, and the way that people can experience them is like there's something to it that gets that reaches deeply into the psyche of people, and I think it has a vastly underestimated benefit.
Yeah.
For sure.
There's definitely more to it than meets the eye, and like, what's really interesting about creating a world rather than creating a story that people have to play out is the fact that you can create your own stories. You can create your own value, and as a result of that, you see the spontaneous order emerging, if you want to speak in economics terms, in terms of economics, of not only like networks of friends, networks of teams, people helping each other beat the game, helping people tell stories, but also networks in the real world of people who maybe like those authors you inspired, or the developers who, you know, really learned how to code by playing in these worlds. It's really amazing, and it's something where, like, if you have something like that, which not only gives people an outlet for free creativity and maybe also kind of imagining a freer life for themselves, but it's also kind of a way of coordinating this real impact in the real world. That's exciting. Like, a free place for people to come together and be themselves, that, I think, is, again, going back to the political question, it's a very powerful thing, and something I'm very excited to see, like, how this plays out with things like, as we get virtual reality advances, and this can become more integrated with the real world, so to speak. I think we're going to see a lot more significance to this. But I'm wondering about Chaz here, because Chaz is quite the gamer himself, and I'm wondering what his experience has been like in sort of exploring maybe the more fun side of this. What have you really enjoyed playing in your experience with virtual worlds?
Well, I don't know how much I can contribute, because my first experience with virtual worlds was actually very similar to Eric's. It was actually in online chat rooms in like the mid-90s, and I was really into Star Trek. Like my big sister watched it all the time, and so I was about 10 years old. And when I first got exposed to the internet, I got into these chat rooms, and I found one, and they called it Simming. And it was basically role-playing, but for, you know, Star Trek nerds. And so we would basically act out an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation, and you would have someone that would control the environment type thing, sort of the dungeon master or the game master, I guess. And more recently, I've been playing World of Warcraft. I've actually probably been playing that about 10 years now, off and on. And Eric just gave me a look.
I didn't realize. I was an EVE Online player for a good amount of time, and I took it very seriously. So I've been there. I understand. It's just like, it's kind of mind-boggling. Like EVE, I think, is coming up on its 12th anniversary, and I think World of Warcraft is 11th or something, a 10 or 11 something like that. It's just, it's stunning how long those virtual worlds have just sort of persisted.
Yeah, and World of Warcraft has actually become more of a casual virtual world, because it's not, I guess, as hardcore as EVE Online is. But I have played games similar to that, one called Lineage 2, and that's one reason I didn't graduate from college until I was 20 years old.
College, what's it worth anyways?
Yeah, those games, they can really suck you in, especially Lineage 2. What made that so addicting was it didn't have a like just a linear story. It was kind of a sandbox for creating your own stories. And the alliances that were formed, kind of like an EVE, they created their own drama and their own stories, and that's what made it so interesting. You know, just going on the message boards and, you know, seeing the two leaders of the biggest opposing alliances flaming each other. That was always the best part.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of good times playing those types of games.
Yeah, that's the thing that I think strikes me the most about virtual worlds. And the ones that attract me the most are the ones that implement a sandbox. And for the listeners who aren't familiar with this word, which is common among gamers, a sandbox is just a open world in which there's no rigid framework that you have to go, no objective that you have to accomplish. Instead of one objective, there's, you know, thousands or tens of thousands or infinite numbers of objectives, things that you can do. And that sort of steers these virtual worlds in from a game, from the side of the spectrum that's a game, to one of a true alternate reality, where, you know, here we are in this reality, we can go do whatever we want. There's certain, you know, pressures and rigidities of the things that we do, but there's consequences to those things, right? We can literally do anything we want, so long as we're willing to deal with the sort of natural resistance of our surroundings. In a virtual world, the same types of things exist, except that those rule sets, they're different. And they're different in different games. And a sandbox game is one that sort of embraces this idea of having a different rule set. And it's just like, those are the types of games that where you can really just go experiment with different, whether it be, you know, hierarchical structures for an organization, solo structures for, you know, your leadership ability, or in the case of writing, maybe it's just in the skill set of just simply writing and getting out this descriptive narrative around an individual or an organization. So, yeah.
And this raises a really interesting topic for me too, because we're going to be talking later with our guests about the ideas of alternative governance. And this idea in virtual worlds of these different rule sets that emerge and that are programmed by design into these games relates a lot to this idea of panarchy, which is kind of more an obscure term in political theory, but proposed by this Frenchman in the, I think, 1860s, named Paul-Émile Dupuy. I believe I'm saying that correctly.
Not bad.
And this idea basically of competing governments that individuals can basically don't belong to any nation state by territory, but they can choose the systems they want to live under. And it's a pretty funny essay if you ever read it. It's just called Panarchy, so anarchy with a P, the less fun version of anarchy, but still an interesting essay if you want to understand sort of different theories of government. And I'm wondering sort of about your thoughts on this. Do you think this is something we'll see now in the future with things like virtual worlds emerging and becoming a more important part of people's lives, with things like seasteading and intentional communities, with things like obviously blockchain governance like BitNation? Do you think this is a practical thing, for one, that people will be one day have a lot more choice in the kind of government political structures they want to live under? And two, do you think it's a good thing? And to what extent do you think it's a good thing?
So, if not,
it could be a very bad thing. I don't want to assume anything here.
Okay. Well, now we get into these interesting political topics. But
oh boy.
So I have to admit, I have not read the Panarchy paper. I will definitely go back and read it now. My perspective on what this is that it is a manifestation of the very concept of a meritocracy within a true anarchy. So a true anarchy means that there's literally no enforced anything, right? There's none of these rules that are forcing anybody to do everything. And that sort of reduces, when you boil that down, it gets down to this concept of liberty, where everything is based on individual, personal choice. You are not ever, under any circumstances, forced to do anything by anyone, and that includes by a government.
Yeah.
In a true anarchy, what happens is not saying that you're not forced. It's not saying that these structures don't exist. It's saying that they're not forced, right? It's saying that everything is opt-in. Everything is driven by the merit of the value that someone is delivering to that system. And I think the idea of a panarchy may be a more consumable way for a lot of people who are familiar with this nice safety, this sort of like the system that we have today, where you navigate the bureaucracy and you climb the train and you do whatever you got to do to get where you want to be happy. I think it's a more consumable version of this, because it's saying that for the people that don't want to step up and go lead people and go like carve out their own corner of the world, it's saying that there's a place for them, but it's a place for them to sort of fall within a structure that isn't forced, and I think that's the difference. It's a subtle difference. It's that no longer am I forced to abide by one governance structure just because of the simple premise of where I live, within some arbitrary line in the sand because of geography, blah blah blah.
Because geography.
That's the only remote explanation that you can provide, because it's completely illogical. It allows them to say, well, I have like 5 or 10 or 100 different choices of the sort of structures that I want to follow right now. And you start getting into these things like contract-based societies, where you simply opt into contracts, and then you're obligated by those contracts to participate in a certain way. Today, if you look at the structure of government and how society functions in most countries around the world, is you're forced into one set of contracts, and it's centralized law, right? With a panarchy, which again is emergent from an anarchy, right?
Yeah.
I think that a panarchy cannot exist without an anarchy.
I would say that's a good interpretation of it, for sure. It does have sort of an emergence property, and it's again very choice based, very laissez faire.
Well, the point is that you get to choose rather than be forced into one. And I think it's a fantastic concept. I think it may be a good way to introduce people to these much broader concepts of liberty, true liberty, being a free man, right? The free man of the land, not governed by anyone, which historically we've been sort of trained into thinking is sort of like an outlaw, a maverick. He doesn't follow the rules of society, so therefore he must be dangerous.
Eric is shooting like guns into the air right now.
Yeah. And wearing my big 10-gallon hat.
Indeed.
So,
no, yeah, it's a fascinating thing. Like, I think that is probably the best explanation for it. That it's obviously the writer. It's hard to classify the writer if you read this essay. He's clearly a liberal in the classical sense, but kind of the idea that individuals have choice on the forms they choose. not, but they don't have to submit to monopolies anymore is a very interesting idea. Something that I think an anarchist could get behind, as well as someone who's more concerned with the forms and the culture of it. It's really funny in this essay as well. I would highly recommend it, of course. he says that, you know, in this system, we probably really won't have to maintain militaries or police forces other than for show and parades. it'll just be like, if you really want to pay for parades and stuff with people dressed up, we'll have those, and only the best looking men will be soldiers. We won't have to hire all the rest of them. It's a really interesting essay, and this is something our next guest, Suzanne Tempelhoff, has talked about a lot. One of our next guests, we look forward to also talking to Dan Metcalf, but she's recorded a talk with Ted called "To Be Governed by Ted," and she kind of talks about this idea of panarchy and its modern application. So we're looking forward to talking to both of them about how blockchain technology and the projects they're working on are intersecting with these cool ideas for people creating their own ways of living in the world and with others. So we're being joined this week by Dan Metcalf. He's the CEO of XC and BlockNet, and he's joining us to talk about some two cool and decentralized projects. Thanks for joining us, Dan.
Hello, welcome, thank you. Glad to be here.
We're glad to have you, and unfortunately our other guest was unable to join us today, but we're really looking forward to talking to you about the projects you're working on and sort of how you became involved in them. So the first question I would ask is sort of we gave sort of a brief introduction, but I'd love to hear your story about sort of who you are and what you're working on with XC and BlockNet.
Sure. So, you know, I'm somebody that grew up as the technology was really being brought out, computers and then laptops, and now we have mobile. And with that, I've always been fascinated by kind of the cutting-edge technology that comes with that. And with that, you know, we have Xcurrency. I got involved with Xcurrency because I felt like there was a need for something different in the altcoin space. You know, not really to compete with Bitcoin, but to offer a solution that was really privacy specific and focused. And I didn't think there was anything in the marketplace at the time doing that. And it's been quite an adventure, ups and downs, highs and lows, challenges, as with anything that complex that's going to happen. But it's been a great project. And, you know, the community and the people that have been involved have been great and tremendous. So that in and of itself was really, really, you know, an interesting concept that really secured for me the direction moving forward. And with that, it became apparent that within these digital communities, you have basically these mini communities of all these different altcoins. And if you could link those together and embrace and harness that, it would be revolutionary. So that's how I came up with the idea for BlockNet. And it wasn't something that, you know, I just woke up and had the idea. It was something, you know, each day I was like, oh, if we could do this or we could do that and have that in place, then we could leverage that moving forward. Because right now there's a lot of ideas and a lot of things going on, but nothing really is taking a solid foothold in the business marketplace. And that's ultimately where these things are going to thrive, is with consumers and businesses that are using these services day in and day out. And microservices and the Internet of Things is really where everything is going. So if you could envision the ability to launch and deploy microservices within any altchain, based on a fairly open platform, you know, you could now create a whole new marketplace that could be embraced by people, that's completely decentralized and not controlled by any single authority. And I think ultimately that's kind of what we all want to embrace at the end of the day.
I definitely agree. And, you know, with that question asked, how did you get into decentralized tech? And, you know, what were your influences and what ideas or projects really influenced you? And because a lot of people came in through Bitcoin, but others really came in from other odd places where you see it and you go, you know, wow, that was a weird, you know, a weird way to start, a weird origin. But how about you? Where'd you come from there?
Well, it actually started with Napster, you know, with their decentralized technology. But it became more with that. Once I got into Bitcoin, you know, I really started to embrace and understand the true power. And it's not about the currency. It's, you know, it's about that shared database, that shared ledger system underneath it. And so that's kind of where it brought me a whole nother step. And then as the concept of applications or decentralized applications running on that type of technology, that's kind of where just my mind went, wow, that is really where, you know, in 10 to 15 years, anything that's not running on this is going to be outdated.
It's a very interesting story, and I'm sure a lot of people came in through Napster and came in from different routes.
Well, yeah.
Go ahead.
Let me just add with that, because part of my background has been developing ad hoc networking systems, so it was really a combination of that experience with seeing what was happening with technologies like Napster to create these ad hoc systems, and then to combine the trustless power of what Bitcoin is doing, you know, that's kind of really where it all came from.
It's interesting that you say that too, because on a side tangent with Napster, you know, we've had guests on in the past and talking music thing, and I actually worked in music too, and I saw what was happening, and I tried to get a label at the time to say, hey, pay attention, you know, here's what you can do to promote your record. Like, I think the best quote on it is when Neil Young said that piracy is the radio of today, because it is. It's like, that's how people, you can get heard. You don't need to rely on gatekeepers, and I mean, you know, labels help, but still, there's other ways. And it opened up a lot of eyes, and it's weird that it took something, you know, as ubiquitous as music to open those eyes, and it really happened across industries. But when it happened to money, it's kind of like, people were so not ready for that. People were not, I mean, the music industry wasn't ready for Napster, but the world was not ready for this to happen to money. And that's why, you know, the growth is slow, and I think it's solid. So I think, you know, overall, all the influences where people are coming from are really toward one goal, and it's really, you know, it's getting closer, and more money is being poured into it, which is great.
Absolutely. And if you think about, like, Uber is another example which came out of nowhere and just kind of shook the foundation of what's already there. And, you know, you can already see how that's crumbling the existing systems and legacy infrastructure that's in place for that. And Bitcoin is just another example of that technology that once, and it's already there. I mean, when I look at Bitcoin, I envision it's almost like this financial backbone network. And that's kind of why altcoins do have a place, because you don't want to mess with the core fundamentals of Bitcoin. You have a network that's what I call production ready, transferring all this value daily, and you can't really experiment with that. You can't do that in that type of environment. So that's kind of where altcoins have a huge potential, because they can try different things, and then once that technology is mature, then it can kind of scale up to work with Bitcoin.
You know, and it's interesting you mentioned that about altcoins, because I've found value in altcoins myself, and I mean, not economic, you know, and there's tons of them that are just there to make a buck, but you know, I think this idea that Bitcoin is the platform is inherently just not, it's not provable, right? There are so many people that are so bullish on everything being built on Bitcoin that it's like, you know, it's not always the better technology that wins. It's all, you know, every technology can be built on in different ways. Right. And, you know, this is not going to be the only blockchain technology. So it's interesting, because when I was at the O'Reilly Media Summit, a lot of the Pantera Capital people I was speaking with, and I don't want to name names, were very, very, very bearish on any altcoin period. They think that everything should be, you know, on the Bitcoin blockchain, sidechains, whatever way you want to call that. So the fact that the project that I'm a part of is working on Ethereum was like blasphemy to them. And I'm like, no, Ethereum's trying to do things that Bitcoin isn't. It's not trying to be money. And Bitcoin's great for money. But let's try to optimize it for other things. And I think what you're doing is interesting, because all these blockchains are going to need to communicate. There's going to be a need for, you know, whatever's happening on the Bitcoin blockchain to, you know, to transfer to every other blockchain that's out there. So it's a very cool project.
Yep, and for me too, the thing with BlockNet was to harness, you know, developers and the ability to create applications, because that's ultimately, you know, where we talk about what consumers are going to want. And if you look at what happened with, say, Android in the Play Store and Apple, you know, it's these applications that these developers are creating that they're thinking up and they're doing, and there wasn't a high cost to market this. You know, they basically create the application, deploy it within the store, and then with little to no marketing, usually it's just viral, these applications become huge. So the same potential is here for having decentralized applications. I mean, ultimately, that is, you know, having a system that can provide that to people, regardless of the underlying altchain running it or the nodes, you know, that's a win-win.
So you do have two very interesting projects that you're working on here. You have Xcurrency and BlockNet, which I imagine sort of BlockNet kind of came out of Xcurrency. And sort of the work in that. But I'm very interested in sort of asking about the first question, since we're kind of on the point of altcoins. What do you see in Xcurrency that you're doing differently? What problem are you solving with that? And sort of how are you approaching kind of the altcoin space differently, do you think?
Well, sure. So, you know, a lot has changed in a year. And I think when I first got involved in the altcoin space, there was a lot of, you know, just bogus altcoins that had no real function except for monetary value. And my idea was twofold. One was to bring forth an altcoin that was business driven for B2B services. And that's actually something that has really become a top focus lately for us. The second thing, though, is to provide the ability for privacy and private transactions. And we've actually come out with two different mixing type technologies. And, you know, both of them had limitations in how they work. So it's long term, that type of technology really isn't feasible for any altcoin or any blockchain, just the way that they work on there. So with that, you know, we're really focused on coming up with B2B applications that harness the power of the blockchain underneath it. And one of those that we actually just launched was CryptoTopUp.com, and that site is where you can top up your cell phone either with Bitcoin or Xcurrency and soon you'll be able to top up debit and ATM cards. So this is an example of that type of B2B business. And that's, you know, a legitimate business that XC is engaged in with, you know, other vendors for those services. And I think that's also, you know, a first for many altcoins. I don't see many altcoins really being that business focused. Although today that has changed. You know, you have an example like BitSwift, which they've actually launched their own backup system through their wallet. And you know, there's another example of a B2B application that's running on top of a blockchain.
It is quite interesting. It does seem like businesses, in many respects, have been slower to embrace this technology just because of the higher input costs. But I do think there's definitely a huge market for that. Just kind of bring this technology to them in usable ways. Another project you've recently partnered with was BitNation, actually, who Suzanne, the founder, was unfortunately unable to join us. But we'd love to hear sort of about the nature of that partnership, how it came about, and what it's going to entail for XCurrency and for BlockNet, and as well as BitNation.
Well, sure. I mean, I can't really speak on Susan's behalf, and a lot of, you know, my input to that was from the technology side. But fundamentally, the idea is that we'll have this foundation that BlockNet is building with Horizon to support what BitNation is trying to do. And, you know, when you have trustless self-governance, that's a huge step from where we are today, you know, with just the entire, how the whole world views things, you know, to a future plan. So we're building the foundation to support that. And, you know, BitNation is really going to be a bunch of different items, whether you have smart contracts, you know, identity and trust management, all those different things. If you think what a government does today and you take each of those, they actually break down in like mini apps, right? And that's kind of what they're building to run on top of this platform that we're creating. So it's a combination of really concepts for applications with concept for technology working together towards a seamless goal.
Which, that's very interesting. Yeah. Go ahead, Tony.
It is interesting. And I think the thing about business and altcoin for business is true. And I think see that in a lot of projects where the altcoin itself isn't designed around the business, you know, business people, business operations, different, everything involved with that. But I think that applications built on top of it have increasingly been. And, you know, what do you think is going to happen in the next 5 years? Where do you think this is going to go? Like, just, I love prognostication, especially from the hip prognostication with, you know, just like the fun kind where you go, oh, this is what I think is going to happen. And, you know, you're obviously could be wrong, you know, because that's how everything like that works. I think they're very fun. So I like to hear what the brightest people in this space think about.
Well, you know, I'm constantly thinking about how you can decentralize anything that's out there. How can it be decentralized? And how can you turn the power to the people hosting the nodes to get reward for payments for helping to do that? So that's, you know, that within itself is challenges because each one of those functions require specific, you know, logic design so you can prevent people from abusing it. But in theory, you can decentralize anything that uses a ledger or a database or anything like that can be decentralized. But there's also more than that. As you can see what Ethereum is doing, you know, they're taking it to a whole new level with the ability to run scripts across a decentralized platform. So it's, you know, any concept, anything that the government's doing, there's just so many things. The thing is, when you say 5 years, I think that window is too small. I think some of this technology is really looking beyond that. I think the next 5 years you're going to see Bitcoin mature to a certain point, you're going to see businesses really start and to embrace how they can do it. But there's also a lot of logistics because right now, not even the laws like PCI compliance or HIPAA compliance or any of those, they wouldn't even allow you to decentralize any of their data. So those are still challenges that need to be overcome there. Then you have regulatory issues. So all of that's kind of get washed out over the next 5 years. Meanwhile, you're going to have developers creating these decentralized applications. So just like you see how Android first launched and it was in the beginning to where it is today, you know, that we're going to see, I think, a similar road for all of this technology as well.
And what do you think are sort of the obstacles you're facing with that? I mean, obviously, other than regulations, we've seen a lot of predictions of things in the decentralization space, Bitcoin space, happening a lot faster than they actually have in many respects.
Right.
Generally speaking, you know, maybe you can't speak generally, but what obstacles do you face as a project and as a team, and how are you working to overcome those currently?
Well, I think the biggest challenge right now is twofold. One is that, you know, part of what XCurrency is a payment solution, and it wants to be a mobile payment solution. But with that, you need to integrate into legacy networks like from MasterCard and Visa. And unfortunately, they're not really interested in talking to small-time players. I mean, so that's a reality. But there are other inroads to slowly move in that direction. And that's what I mean. Those are the things that are going to take time before you get the recognition so you can move further up in that chain. And I think that those are the challenges. And just like with Bitcoin, you know, years ago it was, oh, you know, we're going to decentralize the world. But the reality is you still have to decentralize the network and the money system, you know, what you're doing today. You have to really make that solid so you have the regulatory issues. And I think ultimately that's a huge challenge depending on where that goes with New York and their Bit license. And I think California is following suit. They want to have something too. So, you know, over regulation could hamper things, but we'll see. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to predict exactly what will happen on that front. But at the same time, as these applications mature, you'll just see them, you know, progress just like any other technology did, like the cloud, for example. When you first had the cloud, it was a lot different than what it looked like today. And it's become this usable, mature technology that, you know, anybody can use on their cell phone or their laptop or their tablet with ease.
Absolutely. And we actually are happy to finally have Suzanne back on, and I wanted to introduce you to our audience and say hello. How are you?
Hi, guys. I'm super excited to be on here. Thank you so much for having me. It's great to connect with all of you, especially Dan Metcalf. Here I've been chatting to you for a very long time, and have so much exciting stuff to share, you know, and I'm really, really excited about the BlockNet, BitNation integration. And so, yeah, it's great to be all on air with you guys.
Absolutely. It's a pleasure to meet you as well, Suzanne. And why don't we go ahead and segue then. We've been talking to Dan sort of about his own obstacles that BlockNet and XC have been facing to kind of user adoption. Let's kind of start off with sort of, can you tell our listeners about sort of who you are and what you're building with BitNation?
All right. So basically, our idea is to build a decentralized governance model because we think the nation state is sort of going out of fashion, and we think there's a better way to do it, you know, rather than create a graphical monopoly on violence. We think we can offer the same services but a lot better, and a lot of it we're using blockchain technology as a third-party component. A third-party arbitrator, essentially. So that includes ID and reputation. It also includes dispute resolution. It includes timestamping and tokenization, which can be used for a very wide variety of things, which I'm sure you're all aware of. And we have gotten a tremendous amount of support for it. You know, since we started to launch BitNation, we got covered in everything from New York Times to Wired to Wall Street Journal to you name it, like all the mainstream media. Everybody's tremendously excited. We have hundreds of volunteers across the world working for the benefit of BitNation. We have just signed up to 1,800 embassies. We have the alpha release getting released in about a week from now. And yeah, I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of things happening that is awesome, you know? Yeah,
absolutely. And I want to go back to something you said there when you were speaking on the government and the role. This is an internal dialogue we love having on the show because we all have different opinions, and that, of course, makes it interesting. Where did you stand when you were, you know, when you thought of like, okay, well, here's this idea of a government, and we are going to utilize technology to replace some of their roles? And with that being said, one of the issues that I always like to bring up is historically government's role in developing technology. Because most of the technologies we use every day, not all, of course, but many, were created by government entities. And it's interesting because we're going on to a field where, you know, government roles are slowly being, I think, reduced, slowly, very slowly. And it's interesting, and everyone comes in with a different perspective. And in this field, there's a lot of anti-government perspective, whereas just to end this with my personal opinion, mine is government served a role. It was the best we had. But with technology can do it better, why aren't we using that? That's my thing in a nutshell. Where do you stand?
I come from it from an anarchist perspective, philosophically, in the sense that I believe in the non-aggression principle. So I believe basically in voluntary agreements between consenting entities, whether they are individuals or groups or AI. And so I believe the current nation-state monopoly is wrong in that sense because it involves non-consenting entities. Because just because you are born in a random place on Earth, you know, you have to consent to a government, a part of the government oligopoly you have not necessarily chosen and not necessarily want, you know, and I believe that is wrong. So I'm basically against the nation state construct. That does not mean I'm against governance by any means. I think governance services by and of themselves are hugely valuable. Like, for instance, the ability to be able to protect your assets through incorporating a company or through getting married or through titling your land or whatever it may be, or proving your identity, etc., is extremely important in life, in our collective well-being. So I have nothing against governance. I have, from my anarchist perspective, something against coercion and the use of violence to impose those things.
That's a very interesting perspective and a good question to ask. We always ask ourselves. We've been talking to Dan a little bit of sort of about how BitNation will be partnering with BlockNet to kind of decentralize these applications of governance to the blockchain. But one of the questions sort of I have, and certainly there's been sort of discussion of this in regard to BitNation and other projects like it, is sort of balancing the user benefits of having something like maybe title or property protection with something like having a passport or a license or even a marriage title. Is there sort of a delineation for you between sort of what are valuable services that a government provides and what are actually things, services government provides, which are inherently not improved by a blockchain? Is there anything sort of like, what would be the user benefit for me, I suppose, in sort of putting a passport on a blockchain in a system where we currently have passports with provided by governments?
Well, I think that, you know, everything that can be automated are beneficial to be on the blockchain. I think there are some things that cannot be automated, and those include some aspects of, for instance, insurgency or like private security and some aspects of diplomacy. And those things will be services that are not part of the blockchain, and that's okay. Everything does not have to be on the blockchain. You know, but we would like to automate everything we possibly can through the blockchain.
No, I'd like to add too as well, you know, one of the key things is that you can't counterfeit something like this once it's on the blockchain. And that in of itself makes this technology extremely valuable. And it's not just for the people, it's even for governments too, you know, that want to embrace this, the future. Because once you have it in there and you're able to prove that identity, now you have something that can't be counterfeited. And that in itself is extremely valuable.
One question I might have for following up with that, I suppose, is certainly coming from that perspective then, is there any concern then about governments being able to use something like an unforgeable record, like an unforgeable passport on a blockchain, to actually sort of be more oppressive to individuals? That's certainly sort of one of the trade-offs we see in this security thing. But I'm wondering sort of both of you, if you have any response to this.
Yes.
Is there any danger with governments actually using blockchains against people who want to be more free?
Yes. Please let me answer to that. Yes, that is actually one of my greatest fears, you know. I'm really actively trying to work against that. I think one of the things that will work against that is what Dan is doing with xCurrency. You know, I'm a huge supporter of that. I'm also a supporter of Dash. Basically all the dark wallet movement. And I think it's very important that we actually, as a community, work very actively towards how the government can use it as a tool for oppression, because that is a very likely scenario. And I think we have many ways to counteract that, and we should actively do so.
And I think one of the things that's missing, and as a follow-up to this, in the blockchain community, is this idea of, you know, there's these finite uses for it. And in a conversation I had with Steve Albini, he kept mentioning that finance is one. And then I kind of looked at it, and I was like, you know, he's got a good point. Most of the applications I'm seeing built on here are for finance. And then I'm saying, you know what's necessary? Fire chat's necessary. Communication models are necessary. Manufacturing decentralization is necessary to create independent mesh networks based on hardware. And I think that that's like somewhere where, you know, investment really needs to be put into and there needs to be more interest. Are there other areas, and not just in decentralized tech, but in technology in general, that maybe you think should get more money poured in, more VC capital, and large companies should be paying more attention to?
I'm not sure decentralization is actually always the right question, you know. Decentralization is great because it provides, obviously, a central point of failure. But I am not sure that's always the most accurate point to focus on. I mean, if you look at, like, for instance, services like timestamping, being able to use to record evidence on a decentralized database without any centralized third party, you know, I think that may somehow be more important than even a currency application of it.
So one of the questions we were kind of interested in asking you, and particularly asking Dan, since you're sort of working with different areas of this sort of decentralized or blockchain-based these applications, is where you see the most challenges to adoption. Obviously, Dan was telling us a little bit about financial regulations, about problems with being adopted by legacy networks. And we certainly want to get his follow-up on that. But from you, Suzanne, since your project's really working with individuals primarily, what problems do you see to people adopting sort of blockchain-based governance applications? What problems do you see with governments that your project may have to overcome? And then we'll go to Dan sort of for his follow-up on that with the BlockNet.
Wow, that was a lot of questions baked into one. I don't know where to start.
what's the biggest challenge for BitNation right now?
Well, that's an entirely different question. The biggest challenge for BitNation right now is money, you know, but that's an entirely different question from what you asked. But so let's get back to your adoption challenge. Okay, so I try to look at everything from a scalability perspective. I am not interested in convincing you or me or, you know, the next door neighbor at whatever we're doing. I am motivated by convincing a $1 billion market, which is currently in the developing world, because SystemD, which is a $10 trillion market, which includes people who are not incorporated and do not follow regulations and are unbanked, do you need these services urgently, just to secure their basic assets, their corporate equity, their land titles, everything they own, etc., to assure prosperity for their next of, you know, their children and so forth. So that's the market I'm focused on. I'm not focused at all on short-term profits. It couldn't be more irrelevant to me, really. And so, yeah, I think the biggest challenge in those markets are basically BTC adoption. I mean, the two are, like, very tightly tied together. Like, the strategy BitNation is taking is basically piggybacking on BitNation right now, on Bitcoin right now. So we're targeting, like, a market where remittance is high, like Mexico and Philippines, and also markets where the economy crash regularly, like, you know, Cyprus or Argentina, and, you know, other sort of very Bitcoin-friendly markets like Turkey, South Africa, etc., where the regulations are still slack enough, so people just won't care about alternative economy getting up to speed with the sort of mainstream economy, if you like. And where there is a lot of innovation going on because they won't get cracked down by NSA, you know, if they just try to do something remotely original or interesting, and where they truly need it because they don't have access to normal banking services or normal governance services. So those are target audiences, and the way we're reaching them is for our ambassador network, which is spread throughout basically the world right now, and we just signed up a deal to have 1,800 embassies enabled. So We are getting there, you know. I can't claim anything in terms of adoption since we haven't released alpha version yet, but we will within a week, though. So, yeah, I mean, we're definitely going to hit all those target markets very hard, very quickly.
And Dan, would you say also that Xcurrency is sort of targeting a similar group, System D, sort of this billion unbanked around the world, or is sort of a slightly different currency or consumer market for Xcurrency?
No, I would think that, you know, there is no real bucket to contain really the consumer that we're going after. Ultimately, though, I think the biggest challenge is usability. You know, ease of use of the application, ease of use of transferring the asset, whether it's the underlying coin or some type of smart contract. That's really, for me, where the app needs to be. It needs to be mobile. So you need to have the ability to interact with people in an ad hoc manner and exchange, you know, these assets, these tokens, whatever it is. And so for me, that's the challenge, is we need better software. We need better UIs and better interfaces so that it's 100% seamless for the end user. And, you know, so that until we get there, you know, it's hard to quantify kind of some of these other variables.
I agree with Dan 100%. And I think that's where we actually interact, you know. BlockNet provides a lot of the backend we need, and we provide a lot of the UI, UX, and market adoption they need.
Well, it's a very interesting partnership, and I'm excited to see sort of where this goes for y'all. But before we wrap up here, we kind of wanted to ask, and Suzanne kind of mentioned a few of these earlier on, but what other projects are you seeing out in the space that you recommend to our listeners, or that you're particularly excited about just as fans of this technology?
I'll go ahead, Suzanne. I'll go last.
Oh, well, I was just about to ask you if you wanted to go ahead.
well, yeah, so for me, one of the other projects that I've recently connected with is Ethereum, and I'm going to be taking over the organization of the Boston meetups for anybody who's interested in getting involved in writing, you know, decentralized applications moving forward. So stay tuned for more information on that. But that's, you know, those are the type of projects that I like to embrace, you know, projects that are really building and moving forward and allowing people to do their own applications like that.
Yeah, I would actually second Dan on that one. Like, I also think Ethereum is one of the most interesting projects in the space. I know the Turing completeness do entail some security deficits, but I think it's, you know, if we look at it as a purely a smart contract platform rather than as a currency, it doesn't really matter. And I think also I'm very excited about the next technology and, of course, my partner's Horizon, which is an improvement of the next paradigm code. And, I mean, I think they're doing amazing work. Like, I used to be sort of like Bitcoin, you know, like, I hated altcoins for a very long time, and then when I sort of emerged into like the whole altcoin space, I got very excited about the amount of pure innovation, you know, that was in the space and everything they were coming up with and how like truly decentralized it was in terms of just activists doing different stuff and coming up with their own solutions. So now I am extraordinarily optimistic about it. And I think for sure the next on Horizon technology and in combination with the BlockNet technology is the very best of that space.
Yeah, absolutely. There seems to be quite a mind-boggling array of projects out there in the space, and we're excited to cover all of them. That's our goal. We really enjoy talking to you all today. But before we close, I wanted to ask first, Dan.
Yeah, and Suzanne, I also want to give a shout out to like Dash. I also think Dash is cool.
That's a cool name, and that's probably a cool purpose. So that's something I definitely am interested in using myself at some point. Completely legally, though. So anyone listening in, very legally. But before we close, first with Dan and Suzanne, how can listeners find out more about your work, get involved, find you online? So we'll start with Dan on that one.
So sure, right now the majority of discussions are happening on Slack. You can follow our Facebook and Twitter feeds for more information, but if you want to join in and get involved, there's a Slack for Xcurrency and BlockNet. And I'll make sure that the links for that, the invites, are available on the websites, so anybody can go there and get that information.
And Suzanne?
www.bitnation.co. We'll very soon be updating our website, and it's going to be a lot fancier and more good looking than it is right now. And when the alpha release of the platform is coming out, it's going to blow your mind, so stay tuned for that.
And we want to thank you both again. Our guests today have been Suzanne Tippelhoff and Dan Metcalf.
Thanks, guys.
Decentralized was edited and produced by Chaz Ferguson. Music written and performed by Tony Lees. You can download past episodes at decentralized.fm or on SoundCloud at soundcloud.com/decentralized-podcasts. And follow us on Twitter at @decentralizeall.